This podcast is from Allegro Non Troppo on Joy Melbourne 94.9 radio station, Melbourne, Australia, and is produced for you by Adam, Peter and Robert. Hello and welcome to Allegro Non Troppo, coming from radio station 3JOY Melbourne in Victoria, Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station, broadcasting via satellite across Australia on the Community Radio Network, presented by Adam Stobbs
and Peter Forty. All of us have from time to time had personal and social issues with religion.
For a long time, Australia was a solely Christian country, but that's changing.
Social and community attitudes to religion and Christianity are changing.
Many of us have been brought up with some religious context, and like it or not, it's part of who we are.
The concept of God, heaven, life after death seem to be a common theme in most religions, but when you look at countries like the USA, for example, one can see extremes in all sorts of social religious outcomes in a country that's basically deeply religious and not a religious fervour based on reason, but also has 65,000 homicides a year.
In Australia, though, it seems that people are actually turning away from religion personally, but still maintain the cultural linkage. Why is this so? What is the concept of God, and why was God invented?
To discuss his life, experiences and thoughts, we're pleased to welcome Father Geoffrey Terry.
Hello, Geoffrey. Now, is it correct to call you Father Geoffrey, or should Father Terry, or Geoffrey, or Jeff? How should one address you?
Well, I was born Geoffrey, so Jeff will do.
Okay. Welcome to the show. Is this your first experience on radio?
Almost.
Okay. Well, we're really pleased to have you here. I'm particularly personally fascinated by the concept of religion and why it's in our lives in the first place. I sort of subscribe to the theory and the postulations of Richard Dawkins. Are you familiar with them?
Oh, yes. He's a good Anglican, I think.
Oh, dear me. But, you know, everything has to be proven on by fact, evidence and reason. I just thought I might reel off some statistics for our listener to talk a little bit about religion. I had always thought from news and everything that the biggest religion and the huge religion that was sweeping the world was Islam, that there were more Muslims than anything else. That's not the case. There are 1,266 million Muslims in the world. So that's about a billion. It's about a billion Muslims. There are 2.1 billion Christians. 32% of the world is Christian, but that's dropping. 19% of the world are Muslims, and that's growing. The next biggest one, which is just about as big as Islam, is Hinduism. There's 828 million Hinduists, and it's 13%. The number of people who say they have no religion in the world is 775 million, and that's dropping 12%. So there are more people turning to religion, it would seem, than turning away from it. The next one is a big, huge drop. 6% of the population, that's 390 million, are Chinese folk religion. And then the next one, which is about the same, is Buddhism. 6%, and that's somewhere between 350 and 1.6 billion, but people drop in and out of Buddhism quite a lot, apparently, and there's lots of different variations of Buddhism. 4% of the world's population are into tribal religions, and then there's about 2% of the population have the religion of atheism. Well, I consider myself to be an atheist because I don't believe in God at all, but I prefer to say that I have no religion. Rather than atheist. Is there a difference, do you think, Peter? Jeff?
I wouldn't have thought so. Maybe there is.
I'm not quite sure about what is an atheist, because most of them are well-educated. They know the Christian faith and many aspects of other faiths. And without being provocative, I think they've made a faith statement. But, you know, I could be crucified for that.
Though possibly one of the differences, you can have no religion, maybe, but still believe in God. No formalised religion.
Yeah. Okay.
I think the overwhelming number of people do have a belief in God in this country. That obviously, statistically, in the Christian sense, they don't apply that in sitting pews and whatever, but they certainly have a religious base and there are aspects of their life that is, I would say, very spiritual, and I don't mean barracking for Geelong or any of those, but there's a deep spirituality you find in a lot of people. And strangely, when you come to the time of burial for some of these people, they want the full works, and statistically, I believe, most people still want to be buried by a Christian minister, as if he's got power in the end of his fingers or something, but... we are touched by our heritage. I have no doubt about that.
Can I share a moment with you? I get these really bad migraines, like unbelievable pain.
Let me heal you, my son.
And one of the things I do when I'm in a really bad, really bad migraine is I recite stuff over and over to try and take my mind off the pain. And I know reams of poetry. I memorized huge amounts of poetry. A few weeks ago, I had a really bad one, and I was reciting something, and I suddenly stopped. I was reciting the Lord's Prayer. I thought, oh my goodness.
So? A lot of politicians do that day after day.
But here's me. I particularly go out of my way not to take on religious iconism and to let myself think I've been brainwashed by religious stuff. And here I was in pain reciting the Lord's Prayer. I thought, God.
And you're an atheist, mate.
That's probably out of desperation, though, for any religious
thing. No. I mean, I don't see a problem in reciting the Lord's Prayer. In fact, anything else. I don't know much Islam, so I can't recite much of there. Yeah. But I think we take hold of things that are meaningful to us, and if that's something that helps you along the way, you know, the Lord's Prayer is recited in so many ways on so many occasions, and I think people grasp for it, as long as, to quote, it's the old version.
Or not the one that Sister Janet Mead did in the 1970s that became a huge hit.
Can I sing it for you?
Oh, you, sir.
But, I mean, seriously, if there's humour in religion, people constantly say, I love the Lord's Prayer in the old version, so I used to stand up in my little pulpit and read the Greek. And they were totally confounded by the process, but what is the old version? As long as it's something that they can grasp, so we all say Our Father, which art in heaven, or whatever it is, that's the old version, I presume, which is older than me.
Oh, I remember various boarding schools when we used to actually have to write it down. This is how come I know it, and some of the kids who were perhaps not as well educated, you say, Our Father who art in heaven, hello, what's your name?
Or Harold be thy name.
It's quite funny.
Yes.
Okay. Jeff, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your personal experiences. You have been, would have been, an Anglican minister.
Yes, I was ordained an Anglican priest in 1974, so that makes me fairly ancient. I've had an extraordinary experience in that time. And
as what was it like?
What's it like? It's indelible, but, you know, St. Augustine or someone said that once you're in orders and you can't let it go, so... If you're not in the pulpit or behind the Eucharistic table, you're behind some other table and the needs are there. And I think that remarkable Latin word, companio, you be my companion. And the origin is, come break bread with me. And I think the second holiest table is the meal table, and that's where all the good things happen in life. A few arguments too. But basically, the good things of life happen around a table where you share your life and your hospitality with other people, and I have a habit of doing that well, but I'm a simple Bible Christian and also humble.
What led you to become a priest?
Oh, that's a long discussion.
Well, give us a short version.
Well, the shorter version is when I was born, my grandmother said I had healing in my hands. The little skite is I was born in a little country community in western New South Wales, and the electricity went out, the light bulb went out about 10:30 at night, so I was born under a kerosene lantern, but it's alleged I had my eyes open. There's no connection there. But my grandmother said I had healing in my hands, and they always assumed that I was going to be the doctor or something like that. But I have to say, in a little country town, you either joined the PMG, which dates me terribly, or a bank. And so it was a question of going away to school, and I did all of that. But that never left me, that notion of healing, and people that I've had a ministry to over a long period of time talk about that healing in my hands, even migraines, whoever you are.
So, and that was what led you to?
there's a basis of it. I've been in the church all my life. I'm a product of the church. My mother was the good Anglican of Irish stock, and my father was good Catholic of English stock, and he pursued my mother and won her over, and he adopted the faith until the nuns got him in old age, and he died and was buried a Catholic, which was great joy to us, of course. But there was that notion of being involved, and it was a natural progression. Lots of people said, to quote, "Oh, I'm not surprised when I offered for ministry." But I had that notion, I had to test it. And I think you've got to test these things. If you feel God's calling you to a particular ministry, you've got to test that out. Otherwise, you don't know, and you're not loyal to yourself or to God.
Did you feel that calling?
Oh, yes, very deeply.
Did you go through an apotheosis of education to become elevated, to become a priest?
That's a very big word, my son. You can tell me after the show what that means.
Elevation, sort of. Did you find yourself lifted?
I'm teasing you.
Okay, sorry.
No.
I'm a bit of a wanker, in case you aren't aware of it. I like to pretend I know.
What is a wanker? You
I
must
use
tell
big
me
words.
That after the show, too. But I think it was a natural progression. But I was a high school teacher, and I'd like to skite. I was a very good high school teacher. And I had remarkable opportunities as a young person. And so the skills that I had there, I took with me into ministry. And it's been the most remarkable attribute, I think, that I've had. You're always teaching, mainly yourself, about things. But you're always teaching other people and encouraging them to participate in what you're about and what your faith is about.
Jeff, when you give ministry to the community, what do you actually do?
Basically, I'm myself. We're taught in Scripture not to rehearse what we're going to say, what we do. I think it's a very natural thing that we would encounter other people, particularly through touch, although we're not allowed to do that kind of thing anymore. A human being comes in, and in my terms of ministry, I'd always want to sit around the kitchen table, not in the formal dining room, because, you know, they duck off to the kitchen to think, what'll they say? The vicar's here. I'll make him a cup of tea. But around the kitchen table, all the good things happen, and people can level with you, and particularly in times of death, you're the holy person, but it's almost as if you become one of them. And they enjoy that ability then to tell stories about their loved ones. And it's not dissimilar in terms of marriage prep. What you do when you knock on a door for a cup of tea is another kind of matter. Sometimes it's nothing personal, nothing personal. But sometimes some of the most profound activity goes on. People want to encounter, they want to ask profound questions. People have asked me to pray for them, and with the element of touch, what goes on?
So this hands-on sort of situation where they feel they need a physical connection to be able to get some relief, some comfort.
Yes, I can't explain it in that. There's a holy ground that's created between the people, which is an ancient biblical thing, Moses and the burning bush, and he meets God in that context. But you cross over into that holy ground, people invite you into their space as well. And that's where amazing things can happen.
So it sounds to me the ministry that you deliver, rather than standing up and delivering scripture to people and telling them thou shalt and thou shalt not, is you actually act as a social counselor in a lot of ways, connecting people perhaps with just themselves.
True. Yes, I'd get into trouble for saying that I was only a social counsellor, or I didn't get in the pulpit. Pulpit was another experience, you know. You'd spend hours and hours preparing and wondering how you're going to get in and how you're going to get out of such a notion, how they're going to listen for all that time. Most people wrote their own sermons after the first paragraph, I think. The ancient preacher used to thump the pulpit just to get their attention. And
do you know what? What you've just said, this microphone in this studio and this radio station is often like a pulpit, because we get people in here to discuss issues, and the number of times I have to ask them during the interview, please don't bang on the desk with your fists. This is you're doing exactly this. You're not doing that, but no. What I'm just saying is what we're
never
actually doing is this is sort of like a more electronic version of preaching. We're giving out the message to people who might listen.
You've got an enormous power in your hands, man, because people do listen. we're not very good at listening at sermons. I mean, it's estimated we hear less than 10% of what's said. If I gave them a coloured pencil and I asked them to write something down, we might remember a bit more. But to think I could spend 3 hours writing a sermon and they've got it all is bordering on ludicrous, I think.
I have no...
We take things along the way, and if that works for them, that's a wonderful thing.
The way I look at it, what we do here in this radio station on the Community Radio Network, I have no power. I don't even deliver the message. I am the vehicle for people like you who do have the message. Hmm. I sit here and I act somewhat as an enema, and I extract the message out of you, the issues and the elements that I think that the listener would like to listen.
But you're a mediator or a bridge, whatever. Strangely enough, that's a priestly ministry, to act as a bridge between one person and another person. So I don't decry what you've said, but I think you're as very real as the next person.
I have to say, bridge sounds better than enema.
Mm.
Sorry, but you know what I'm like. Do admit. You're listening to Allegro Non Troppo with Adam and Peter. Our special guest today is Jeff Terry, who is... now. So you're a former priest, you're not a priest now.
Oh, well, whatever you like. Most people think I'm ex, just like you've got an ex-wife or an ex-partner or an ex-urban place to live. But
no, you're not an ex-priest, you're always
a priest.
I'm
always a priest, and that's been relived in the countless ministries that I've had since I retired, you know. The countless number of kids, mainly overseas students, who, one, want to talk with someone who can speak the King's English, and someone who can fill in some documents or give them some ideas, even to sit down around a table and see Australian people enjoying themselves, particularly with their children and their grandchildren. And that's been something quite remarkable for me. I've been busy now. The only trouble is I don't get a collection.
Just we have never had children, and I have to say, I was sitting with one of our neighbours at a cafe, outdoor cafe, and they had two little children, and the Easter Bunny came up the street. And just watching the joy of those kids being approached by the Easter Bunny and receiving Easter eggs, it was very moving to see that.
Yes.
Just delightful.
I wouldn't decry that experience. I don't know the connection between the moon and bunnies and chocolate eggs, but there's got to be a nexus somewhere. But it's that inner joy, and children express that time and time again. But I can assure you, you know, there's a Santa Claus, I think, who brings joy too, and sooner or later, as I did, I found my parents playing with my toys. But I don't decry any of those things that bring joy to us, and religion is one of those that... brings extraordinary joy. Can't say it's simply because of the religion. Some people are there because they enjoy the music. Some people go because their friends are there. Some go, would you believe, because of the sermon. There's all kinds of reasons why people would, say, sit in a pew. But what you find through experience, of course, we're all at different stages. And it's quite interesting. Places where you go for a cup of tea, sometimes you hear their whole... concept of religion all at once. Starts with Captain Cook and it winds through. Jesus is there somewhere.
You seem to have had lots of cups of teas over your ministry, Jeff.
Oh, you know, there's a wonderful CD out called More Tea Vicar.
Are you a compassionate? Do you need to be compassionate to be a priest, an effective priest?
Well, I'm inclined to think so. I mean, you may have gauged my ministry's been through my hands and through my actions. It's not a do as I say, do as I do, and I've tried to lead by that. And certainly when there's been major conflict and so on, I've never, ever wanted to be like the others. But to set myself apart and say there's a better way, it's a lesser road, as Robert Frost might say. But in my view, it's a better way. So, yeah, hands-on stuff, whether it's... pulling people out of the gutter, as in Brunswick, or having the police come to your vicarage and belt the life out of someone. You're there for the person.
Oh, really?
Not the authority. I've had some terrible experiences over life that's traumatic, post-traumatic for me now, but I've seen authorities do some terrible things to humankind, just like we do terrible things, you know. Jesus is raised from the dead, but the next day we're knocking him off again just by our actions.
That's That's quite an amazing statement. I'm somewhat reeling from that.
Oh, I know. I'll be burnt at the stake, but, you know, there'll be some kerosene left from Joan of Arc, I'm sure.
One of the things I thought we might do in a little while is we might have a look at some of the core issues and philosophies of religion, and then we might talk about... Oh, we do indeed. While I've got you here, I'm going to extract everything out of you I possibly can. And then we might have a little look at some of personal issues that might affect people who listen to our show. You're listening to Allegro Non Troppo on the Community Radio Network. We would like to thank the Community Broadcasting Foundation for ongoing financial support.
Allegro Non Troppo is produced at radio station 3JOY and heard nationally on the Community Radio Network.
We're speaking with Father Geoffrey Terry at the moment, and we're talking about his attitudes towards religion. I want to ask you, Jeff, is the church beyond reproach?
No, it ought not to be. I'm led to believe it's a servant, and there are servants and servants of servants and servants of servants of servants, and God has servant problems, but it's not beyond reproach. I think the notion is contrary, in my view, to what Christ stood for. I think all of us are brought into disrepute, or we bring ourselves into disrepute. We have the right to be reprimanded if there are things that are wrong. But when a body, mainly the bureaucracy, headed by popes or bishops or other, think they're beyond all of that, then I think the church has got a basic problem. And in my view, the church is in a terrible state of decay, mainly because of implosion, not what the world outside does, but what, in fact, the church does to itself. In fact, if I can just push it a little bit further, it's not exactly on track, but one of my little statements in my Facebook is, God is dead, killed by the church, and I almost believe that.
That's heresy, isn't it?
Yes, and I'll be burnt with matches.
I mean, during the war, for instance, the Pope at the time failed to act on the way that the Nazis were killing various people.
Read about it. Hitler's Pope, and it just, the books, I know that in itself is heresy and disreputed in many ways, but when you read consistently the number of books along that line, you just think, what did the church stand for? And you got to say, in terms of humankind, it didn't stand for much. It was its own position.
Let me comment on this, if I may.
Yeah.
Let's look at the core philosophies of Christianity and the church, Anglican, Catholic, whatever, because those comments that you've made are somewhat consistent, and I'll explain what I mean. Here are the core philosophies of Christianity. Number one, the Bible is the inspired word of God. Number two, there is one true God. Number three, Jesus Christ is the Son of God. Number four, the fall of man. And number five, the salvation of man. Now, let's just go back to the fall of man. We were saying that the church is imploding, etc., etc. The interesting point to notice is that the church is governed, ruled, and it is by men. Right, and men have fallen. Man was created in the image of God. That's Genesis 2:26. However, by a voluntary act of will, he has fallen from grace. So the church is being run by the imperfection, which is man, and therefore cannot be perfect, and it will, by its very, very nature that it's run by man, not be able to fully distinguish good from evil. Is that rubbish?
No, it's not rubbish. I think that's the ideal, and... people like myself always live in hope for the ideal, but
I'm making this up as I go along. No, but that's
well, so
how
am I
see.
Man. there's the ideal, and we would hope to aspire and help to bring that about. I think that's what the kingdom of God is really about. But reality is also there. There's the ideal, but there's the real, and the real is that we fall time and time again. We just didn't do it once in a Garden of Eden, and then put a fig leaf around to pretend we weren't naked. We continue to do it.
Can we have a look at a couple of the other core philosophies of other religions? Because they're really fascinating. The main teaching of Buddhism, the Dharma, focuses on the Four Noble Truths, and that are that, one, life is suffering. The cause of suffering is the desire for pleasure of life. The way to end suffering is by overcoming desire and experiencing enlightenment. And to overcome desire, one must follow the principles of the middle way or the Eightfold Path. These principles of morality, meditation, and wisdom a right or perfect understanding, thinking, speech, conduct, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, and the concentration or contemplating. I think if I had to have a religion, I'd probably pick Buddhism, because I think you get the best deal in the afterlife.
Well, it depends what you want in the afterlife. I mean, Anglicans or someone offers you fine straight wine and good food, but there's your choice. I'm playing around with words, really. But when you look at the basic elements of any of the great faiths of the world, you'll find these common notions arriving again and again. I don't have any truck with any of that in the great truths or whatever. I'm interested that it begins with suffering. You know, you're born into this world with nothing on, and you take nothing out, and you've got nothing on. What you do along the way is a more than interesting experience, but to follow that process, I'd have no problem with that in any way.
You made an interesting comment about suffering. I've had other ministers of religion in here before, and I asked one of them, if God is so great and loves humanity so much, why does he allow people to go through incredible suffering?
Yeah, the problem of evil, I think there are 100,000 books written on that subject, but...
And the answer that I seem to get frequently is that during that time of suffering, of great suffering, people then go through a moment of grace and they move closer to God. It sounds like, if you excuse me, this sounds like absolute bullshit to me.
Well, I can't say those words, but what's for you may well be a way into a more peaceful death, for example. So I won't dismiss it at all, but... I mean, there's enough scripture, particularly Old Testament stuff, that says, you know, we are subject to the refining fire. There are processes we go through that that cleanse us to make us a better person. But I don't think any God intended us to suffer in order to get to that point. So I take, not exception, but I find it difficult to understand why that's at the head of the list. But in my view, what's important in this life is the journey that we make. The consequence is how well we've travelled. So I don't want to talk about pie in the sky. If you do this, this and this, this is going to be the end result. I don't do it for that reason. I do it because of the encounters with people, my encounters with my God on the journey. And that's where the great joy is, I'm afraid, in the eating, the drinking, everything else. If suffering is there, then I must participate in that. And if there's suffering for other people, but I don't think any God has us on as puppets on a string.
We have to suffer. If you don't suffer, if you don't go through the darkness, how would you recognise the light?
Oh, that's a good question. Do you want me to answer?
No, it's just me trying to show off.
Yeah, you've done it well.
Is the what concerns me is the way that some people interpret the Bible. I mean, it can be interpreted in various ways to suit the reader. And that's one of the excuses that's been used to vilify homosexuality. Is that fair? Should the Bible be used in those ways?
I can't use it that way. In fact, I can't use every word in it. I've been taught as a good Anglican that we use it in a thematic way. And so we take readings from Old Testament supported by a psalm. Something good of the New Testament that will open up aspects of that, and then of course a gospel that would underpin any of our Christian teachings. So I don't take the Bible word for word. I've used it in a way that is a journey from the cross, and that brings me back to the cross year after year, that Holy Week and Easter kind of experience. So I see it in a different way. I've also been taught that there are an awful number of myth stories. There are amalgams of stories that have come from different sources. If you take Genesis 1, you'll find there's another story, and I'm using the word story, in Genesis 2. How do I reconcile those? Answer is, I don't have to. I think They're great stories that have been given to us over a long period of time. I'm led to believe that it was part of the corroboree, as it were, the music, the way in which we expressed what we believe to be our faith at that time. Am I bound by all of it? It's extremely difficult to say I'm bound by all of it because of the time in which it was put together, the wisdom that people had at the time, and the way in which change has come upon us in such an extraordinary way in, say, the 20th and this century. So I've got to balance that.
That religions, all of them, have completely missed the point that the multiplicity of diversity of human sexuality is so incredibly diverse and individual, they can't possibly release arching statements to cover the whole lot.
I'd have to agree with your statement. I think in the days in which it was written, I may be wrong, but we're out to preserve the patriarchal society, so we could rape our women, but as long as we didn't touch our boys. That kind of notion is certainly there in some of the earlier Old Testament. Paul, in his writings, certainly named homosexual acts, but he also named a number of other crimes against God, which we'd call sin. I don't think he put any more emphasis on that than other, but he was talking about a society in which we lived, and it included the Greek world of which he was a part, and their views on sexuality were very different to his. So I got to weigh all of that. I don't have the answer, and I don't try and duck it. But if I'm trying to use scripture to back up every argument I've got, I'm in strife.
You're listening to Allegro Non Troppo. Our special guest today is Jeff Terry, and we've been talking about various aspects of religion and how they relate to our personal lives on Allegro Non Troppo across Australia on the Community Radio Network. Our special guest today is Jeff Terry. We've been looking at some of the core messages of religions, the main ones, Christianity, and we've done Buddhism. I thought we'd have a look at a couple of the central thematic core issues of philosophy for Islam, because it's quite interesting. The main tenet to Islam is the absolute sense that there can only be one God, Allah. Now, I'll just disclaim for the listener, if you would like to see where I got all of these quotes from, if you go to the Allegro website, allegro.org.au, full transcripts and bibliography of my notes are available. So the main tenets to Islam is 1. God, Allah, is the source of creation and the disposer of all lives and events. Hence, there is no God but God, and Muhammad is his messenger. All people should become a single ummah, or community, witnessing to that fact. On the Day of Judgment, all will rise from the dead and be sent to heaven or hell. The Quran contains many moral extortions, forming the basic of Islamic Sharia law. It lays down generosity and fairness and requirements for daily prayer, almsgiving, abstinence during daylight hours in the month of Ramadan, and pilgrimage to Mecca. Did I say something wrong, Jeff?
Oh, yes, extortions are quite different to exhortations.
Exhortations. The Quran contains many moral exhortations. I didn't mean to say extortions. So that's the basis. Is there some familiar message in all religions, I think? Let's go away from my notes for a moment and let's have a look at some of the basic things that we think all religions offer. The number one, Jeff, and please tell me if I'm wrong, they all offer some form of afterlife.
Yes, I wouldn't have said it was the first, but certainly it offers some form of consolation, peace, still waters, good.
Do you believe in an afterlife?
I don't have to, because I enjoy it on this earth, and I think that's a process. I was taught that a long time ago, so I can enjoy aspects of heaven and hell. As I journey, if the hill is the suffering, then that's part of the journey, and I embrace that.
I love the way you're getting out of this question.
I'm not getting out of it. I was taught with sensitivity and a fountain pen on paper, and a great man taught us some sensible things, I thought, and I've lived with it forever. So I think the journey through life, whether it's from Ash Wednesday through to Easter Day for us as Christian people, which is really an extension of what you do every day of your life. That notion of journey or pilgrimage or being bread sharers or whatever we are is crucial to the notion. Is there a prize? I hesitate because most of my relatives are dead and are buried in a little cemetery in Western New South Wales. Is that the prize? We care for them and we love them and light candles and put flowers there, but we're talking about a spiritual dimension, and the scriptures haven't told as much. I've quoted one twice now.
Is there a spiritual dimension?
Yes, there is, and I think it's...
How do you know?
Well, how do I know? That's my faith aspect, you see. How do I know? Because the Bible tells me so.
And what is the purpose of faith?
I think faith is a journey, a support journey through life. It takes us beyond ourselves to that notion there is a higher being than ourselves,
so,
although one who is with us, as in Christ.
So faith is a belief which does not require evidence.
I think there's more than enough evidence. I mean, if you were to put the evidence before a court, I think there'd be more than enough evidence to convict any Christian as long as they knew what their faith was.
I'm sorry, I'm not trying to interrogate you or put you in the witness.
I don't feel threatened at all, my friend.
Oh, damn. Or cross-examine you. But I do wish to get to the core of why people believe, because I don't believe in any of this. I don't believe in life after death. I don't believe there is a human spirit or soul. And I certainly don't believe in a human oneness. I think we're all isolated individuals that connect on different levels according to our ability, our education, and what we have inside of us.
Well, I mean, I accept that. Being a good Anglican, I walk with you as my brother. I don't accept what you're saying, but you have the right to say it, and we can share the difference, as it were, probably over a cup of tea or whatever. But I think the faith element can't be put down. There is certainly evidence in an extraordinary number of ways, and we can buy into the notion of evolution, whatever we like. But there is a faith aspect that says, this is where I am prepared to go with what I know, what I love, and what I understand.
How does sexuality... I want to look at personal aspects of sexuality, because it's very important to our listener. Okay, we're a gay and lesbian radio station. We're doing a show which is pitched to gay and lesbian issues. How difficult is it for people within the church to relate issues of their personal sexuality if they're not heterosexual?
I'm pausing because where do you start? I would want to say initially that we're all made in God's image, and regardless of our sexuality, we are part of that creation. And in my view, people of all walks of life are to be embraced. Whether they're gay or otherwise, whether they're a person who slept out in the street, or even, as I remember once, Santa Claus came to midnight mass and asked, would he be allowed to sit in the back seat? Well, of course. Why would you dismiss anyone, really? So, again, you're going to say I'm not answering the question, but I think the church hasn't handled that matter very well, because it's never been asked to think about the subject, and I think it's only in more recent times.
But it's almost completely split the Anglican Church in two.
Well, you want my opinion? I think the Anglican Church needed splitting. You know, unless a grain of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it's got no life in it. And I think we were looking for an issue, and if it's the gay issue, well, I'm sad about that. It hasn't got to be. There are lots of other things we could do with our wealth. Why aren't we looking after people in other parts of the world who need our love and support? Why are we picking on gays and those kind of issues? There are more important things for us to be doing.
There are certain... I don't like to do American bashing, but I'm always fascinated by the
and
way...
you're an atheist.
By the way the Americans have taken Christianity to such a huge... I mean, it's probably one of the most... supposed to be one of the most devout countries in the world when it comes to Christianity. Just have to look at popular...
and your stats.
Documentaries and things like that, and see how many Americans discover that, claim to be Christians, that there's 65,000 murders every year in America. You know how many there are in Australia? 11.
Yes, but look at the way things are changing. I don't remember, for instance, in Melbourne that there were so many bashings going on as there are nowadays.
We just, I think we hear more about them now. I don't think there's really that much change.
I mean, your focus is on the American stuff. I don't understand America. I've only been there once, and I enjoyed Los Angeles, and a train ride right across the countryside back from New York to Seattle was wonderful, and wonderful Americans.
They have things like the Westboro Baptist Church, and they have a website called God Hates Fags. And then there's another church where they believe that if God will come to you and you will move closer to God if you allow snakes to bite you. So they constantly stick themselves with rattlesnake poison.
Yeah, but I think that's extremism or fundamentalism gone awry.
It's terrific documentaries, let me tell you.
Yeah, well, it's outside my experience, so I can't comment. But what I can comment on is a fabulous book one of my sons gave me, Deer Hunting for Jesus. And it's really about the 45 million Americans, white Americans, who are the underclass. They're under the Negro, Hispanic, and all the other. They carry guns, they vote for Jesus and the Republican Party, and yet I shouldn't say it, but the Republican Party are the people who have kept them in that kind of position. Their average income is about $6 an hour, no health until now, and so on. What is there about the great American dream that can create an underclass and maintain it? So I think it's religion is complex. I just don't understand it. God, Queen and Country, but they've got no Queen.
Geoffrey Terry, yes. Let me ask you, as an ex-Anglican minister. Ex-Anglican minister or former or whatever. Where do you see a religion heading in Australia? Christianity in particular. Is it on the way out? Is it declining?
In many instances, the church has willed it so, and that makes me very sad because I've always worked to make it relevant and enrich people's lives. But some of the examples I see are not very good. The church is not very good at being lateral in its thinking and gone further and further apart. So I see very good examples of the implosion that's knocking it on the head. But that's a biblical notion as well. Should it rise from the dead? Well, I'd hope so, because there's still work to be done, a lot of work to be done.
Geoff, thank you for being on Allegro Non Troppo. Let me just hold you to one thing here now that you've got a huge audience and you can't get out. Can we get you back on this show later in the year with Father Nigel Wright?
I'd love to.
I think it'd be really interesting to have both of you here and have another discussion on some of the other elements of Christianity and how it impacts on our lives. Because as much as we'd like to think, no, we're not, Christianity is a part of many of our lives.
Yes.
You've been listening to Allegro Non Troppo. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week. Bye.
Bye.